episode 304 of the Seahawkers podcast. I'm Brandon Schultz of the Military Seahawkers, and joining me from the road, my good buddy and Montana Seahawker Adam Emmert.
I only have one question for you today, Brandon. Can you smell what the Russ is cooking?
I think I'm over the whole responding to let Russ cooking, and it's only a couple days after the game. It's everywhere I look. It's reacting to the fact that, yes, Russ has cooked. And you know what? I'm not totally convinced that 1 week is going to change my mind of what we saw in this past game. But there's more to talk about here.
No, you're not convinced that Russ is going to throw it, you know, 35, 40 times every single game and throw for 4 to 5 tugs and, you know, basically serve up a banquet every week.
Complete about 90% of his passes. Yeah, I would love to see that every week.
Yeah, but not convinced that's the way it's going to go, huh?
Give me at least a quarter of the season before I decide if Pete's philosophy has completely changed. But, you know, I think it tells people, Adam, that Pete Carroll knows what the heck he's doing out there. It's not just, you know, Pete in dinosaur mode.
No, Pete has definitely not been a dinosaur stuck in the past as much as half of or all of Seahawks Twitter and all the numbers nerds seem to think. But it was interesting to see a change in philosophy, at least early on in the game. Well, I mean, it continued all game, but to see the beginning of the game start out so drastically different.
It did, because the Seahawks started out pass on that first three plays of the game. And I wasn't totally convinced that was the way it was going to go, because the very first play of the game was Russell Wilson dropping back and us seeing this happen.
Moving across the formation is Olsen. He goes over to the left side. Now coming back, or goes to the right side. Coming back to the left is Moore. And coming off the corner and just hammering Russell Wilson before he has a chance to do anything is Tack McKinley. The former UCLA product comes off the corner untouched. I think they were hoping he'd come down the line and Russell would be able to get outside. And in fact, he is hit and sacked. A loss on the first play of the game as Tack McKinley gets there in a hurry.
After that happened, you were thinking, okay, well, here they go. It's going to be a run play and then maybe another run play and then punt. But no, that's not what happened.
No, they committed themselves to coming out and throwing early and often, no doubt about it. And it did seem to ignite the offense and, you know, get up early 14 points and, well, not 14 points up, but they score 14 points out of the gate.
Right. Two touchdowns on the first two drives, right?
Right. And so the end result was encouraging, but we did see some typical Seahawks things when it comes to the passing game early on there with some penalties and with the free rusher there on the first play, like you talked about. So it was not perfect. It was not seamless, but I'll put it to you this way. It was fun. But I'm not sure I like it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It was a fun game. Now, we're going to talk about the Patriots coming up in a bit, because that is the Seahawks week 2 opponent. If you're a fan of the run game, then I guess that was the game for you. Maybe you want something a little bit in between. I know that once the Seahawks were up 3 scores, that was the time where you thought, okay, maybe we'll see some more Chris Carson, Carlos Hyde combination. They'll run some clock. That didn't necessarily happen, but I was happy just for myself. These are the games I like to see. I like to see my team up early. They did allow the Falcons to get a little bit closer than I would have liked going into halftime. To me, what would have worked out perfectly, they get the 2 touchdowns in the first quarter. They get the ball back after punting to the Falcons, them going 3 and out. If they get the ball back there and score before the half, I am feeling outstanding about the team. But instead, they go into the half, they're only up 5. Fortunately, they come out and they get the job done in the second half.
Yeah, they did. They came back and, you know, laid the hammer down in the second half. But just like you were saying, they didn't finish the first half very well. And then that's about where I picked up the game when I first got to watch it. So I had a little bit different experience than most people here, because I picked it up right there at half, right where you were talking. And then watched the second half first, and then went back and watched the first half. I had 2 very different feelings after watching both of those in that way.
let's get into that in a second. I want to make sure that we appropriately recognize, because I can feel the tone of this. It's starting off, I think, a little bit more down than I was expecting that it would. Can we talk about Russell Wilson and this performance? Because go back of all the week one games we've seen from Russ, and things have not started out strong. And we saw Russell Carrington Wilson complete 31 passes on 35 attempts, throw for 322 yards, four touchdowns. He had a quarterback rating upwards of 140. He had the 38-yard deep touchdown pass to DK Metcalf on 4th and 5. We had him joining Steve Young as the only other guy to pass for over 30,000 yards and rush for more than 4,000 yards. This was a Russell Wilson game.
Oh, it absolutely was. And it was a masterful performance by Russ. I remember watching a play in the third quarter. They had kind of spread him out a little bit, and he does a little bit of a hard count, sees that they're going to bring an extra blitzer off the edge, brings a dude in motion to pick up the blitzer, but then also by bringing the guy in motion can tell that it's going to be man coverage, and then rips a pass for a completion. And it was just the sheer control that Russell had throughout the entire game was amazing. And whether that was just picking the right guy to throw it to, or controlling the tempo, or knowing when to run, knowing when to break the pocket, knowing when to stand tall. I mean, it really showcased everything that we know to be true about Russell Wilson that the nation just finally caught up with this last year.
That's been one of my favorite themes from the offseason, is that people realizing that Russell Wilson is good, and they're like, wait a second, Russell Wilson hasn't even been voted MVP yet. Not he hasn't gotten one vote. And so that's what makes me think this is his time. And I wonder if he heard enough of that in the offseason to where he's thinking, okay, I got to come out right out of the gates, show people what I'm all about, and get this done, because I think he truly wants to be in that conversation for MVP. And maybe he's tired of this discussion that, you know, he hasn't gotten any of these votes.
Oh, I'm sure he's tired of the chatter. I'm sure he'd like the recognition. I don't think it's one of the huge things that drives him, but, you know, he's a guy that does find things to, you know, kind of pin up on the wall to give him some motivation. I'm sure that's one of them. It's interesting because I heard Florio talk about on his podcast, the idea that he had spoken to somebody close to Russ and that they had basically demanded in a not exactly polite way that the offense was going to change and it was going to feature Russ. Otherwise, he wasn't going to play there his entire career. Now, we all know Florio's obsessed with him trying to go somewhere else. We know that that's like a something that he dreams about at night. And who knows how true any of that is.
That Russell's going to go somewhere else and then he's going to get his salary tied to a percentage of the cap. Salary cap. Those are, I think, Florio's two favorite things to talk about.
Oh, easily. Yeah, no, that he fills up hours of airtime on that. But there probably is a kernel of truth to the idea that Russ finally looked at him and was like, guys,
yeah,
like it's time. Like, this is my team. Yeah. So let me go out there and do it. Let's not screw around. And I did like the approach of coming out aggressive early. I did enjoy that.
I think it worked well against this Falcons team, too, because I was happy with the fact that the defense held up well enough through the first couple quarters of the game, held them back to where the Seahawks could get that big lead. And a big part of the reason why they could do that was Jamal Adams on this defense, Adam. And I know you said that this was two very different halves for you. So you watching the second half first and then going back to watch the first half, watching it in that order, did Jamal Adams stand out in a different way to you?
Oh, absolutely. When I watched the second half first, I was like, oh, Jamal Adams there and he made a play or two. That's cool. And his energy definitely makes a difference. Like, guys are playing with some swag and people are hitting. Like, it felt like, you know, the LOB days in a little bit of, you know, in a way.
Yeah, it reminded you of it.
Right. And then I watched first half and I was like, oh, Jamal Adams, he's doing all the things all the time. You never know. Like, in Pete in his press conference was hilarious. He's like, yeah, we have no idea what he's doing. He's just out there freelancing, which clearly not the case. But you get the sense that Pete is having a ball with this new toy named Jamal Adams that literally is a cheat code to do just about anything you want from the back end of the defense. And I know that makes Pete giddy.
Yeah. He loves defense for one, but
he loves DBs for two.
He loves DBs for two. So Jamal Adams fits perfectly into those two categories. It shows you really where Pete Carroll is able to change, not just in terms of the approach offensively, but in terms of the approach defensively as well. We haven't seen a guy like Jamal Adams perform in this way in a Seahawks defense. That was really fun to watch.
Yeah, it was. Now, you know, people are comparing Jamal to Cam and Earl and all that. And I totally understand why. I mean, they were all safeties and they're all great. And I get that. But Earl was great for a certain reason. Cam was great for a certain reason. And Jamal's great for his own certain reason. And his versatility is that reason. And yeah. I guess one of the things that stood out to me about Adams in this game was he just looked bigger than I expected. When I saw him in a Hawks uni, right? Like, I'd seen him with the Jets, and I'd watched some of his highlights and all that. But it's just different when you see the dude in your gear, right? And he's a monster. I mean, he really is. And he definitely plays that hybrid safety linebacker role to the T. And, I mean, he's like a honey badger with an extra 50 pounds.
You know, his size doesn't really much matter to me. It's the impact that he has. And maybe it is his size that gives him the ability to impact the pass rush the way he does. Because going into this game, I knew that he had that ability in him. You know, we talked about how his six sacks with the Jets last year would have led the Seahawks. But he came into this game and he had more pressures on the quarterback than anybody on the defensive line. Four pressures on the day, had two quarterback hits. He had a sack and he had two tackles for a loss in this game. So you talk about him being all over the field, but really it was his ability to put pressure on the quarterback. They needed that in this game.
Oh, they surely did. How did you feel about the pass rush as a whole?
Not great as a whole. We did see LJ Collier early. We saw something from him. There were 16.
Yeah, and then where did he go?
I don't know.
Like he wasn't hardly on the field much after that.
The one guy which stood, he jumped out at me more on the field than he did in the box score was Benson Mayoa. And a part of that was, I just don't remember Benson being that big of a dude. And so that was a little bit surprising for me, and that's what jumped out at me. But in terms of guys on the defensive line, you had Jaron Reed and Bruce Irvin with three pressures apiece. LJ Collier, he had two, and then you had a few guys with one. So there really wasn't enough pressure on Matt Ryan, especially considering the number of times that he dropped back when they knew he was dropping back to pass.
Okay, so have we done enough like gushing stuff to talk about some of the things that didn't go good? Like, yeah. Can I talk about that now?
I think so. We're just trying to get a little bit of a balance here.
Yeah, yeah, and that's great because it's been cool. Like, I'm on the road, obviously, for this week, and so I have been driving back from Arkansas the last 2 days, and it's given me a lot of time to listen to all the national shows, all the other Seahawks pods, which I never do, right? Uh-huh. And just the giddiness that everybody is talking about this performance, like, oh my God, like they're going to the Super Bowl. Like, I mean, just everybody is losing their catfish. And it's funny because, you know, we all do this a little bit when it comes to week one, the overreactions. It's just natural. I mean, we haven't seen ball for so long. And especially this year, we're all super freaking stoked to see some ball, right? So it's real easy to overreact. So I definitely wanted to balance that out a little bit. And when you said, well, I can see the tone of this show, you're kind of going to go negative. Well, it's not that I'm going negative. It's just that I've heard all of this gushing for 2 days. And I'm like, well, yeah, and that's all true. But then there's some things. And number one was a pass rush. And you said it exactly right. The pass rush was pretty much non-existent when they knew that Matt Ryan was going to be throwing the ball. And that's the whole point of having a great secondary and having an offense that lights it up. The offense lights it up, puts the other team down a bunch of points, the secondary covers well, and then the pass rushers can pin their ears back and go after the quarterback. And in that situation, which is the most ideal situation for you to get after the quarterback. Matt Ryan just stood there all freaking day long. He could have baked cake. It was really disappointing. And the only time that they really did start to get some pressure is when they tried to heat him up with a couple blitzes.
Yeah.
And that ain't going to fly. I'm sorry. Like, if we're going to depend on that all year to be the way our pass rush works, that ain't going to work. But I'm not saying that they're not going to get better. I think they will find some ways to, you know, work the front four, maybe some more stunts, things of that nature, to try to increase the amount of pressures. And a lot of people measure pass rush just in sacks or even the pressure stat, which, good luck, you know, who knows? That's so subjective. Right. I mean, people like St. Perry. I'm just saying, by the eyeball test, Matt Ryan stood there and surveyed the field way more times than he didn't, like by a lot.
I think that's QB hits is probably a good number to measure it by. And when you do look at those numbers, it's not that impressive either. I think it was maybe I've seen seven, I've seen eight QB hits. And some of that depends on how they measure it too. PFF's good because they don't, some of them double up. If it's a sack, it's also a QB hit. And they like to separate those out. So I do like to go by their numbers for pressures and hits. And so they have the Seahawks down as having seven hits on the quarterback. And when Matt Ryan is dropping back, let's see, how many times did he drop back to pass in this game?
Like 51?
56. He had 56 dropbacks, and the defensive backs got a hand on him seven times, not counting the, two times? Jamal Adams got a sack. Mayoa got a sack as he was running out of the pocket. And I think those were the only two.
Not only that, Matt Ryan's a statue.
Right. Yeah.
He's not one of the mobile quarterbacks.
No.
So that was.
You know where he's going to be. He's going to be in the pocket generally.
Oh, yeah. And Schlereth told you all about his footwork and how it always is in the exact same spot all the time and blobbity blue, and had a little gush fest over Matty Mediocre. But I should give Matt Ryan some credits, because by God, Matt Ryan must be really good. I've been totally underestimating him this whole time. I can't believe that I didn't see it before, but he had 470 odd some yards, Brandon.
450.
Lots of yards.
450 yards.
Yards. He had so many yards. Mattered so much.
Yards don't matter.
Yeah, yards still don't matter. And Pete wasn't upset about giving up a ton of yards either. You listened to him after the game, and when people brought up the fact that the secondary got torched a little bit toward the end of the game, he's like, yeah, I was watching what they were doing. I was watching the scoreboard. I was watching the clock run down. We were fine. Plus, they end up getting another field goal to put them up once again once they did get that easy touchdown, just driving down the field and not playing much of any defense at all, just making sure that nobody got behind him. And yeah, in that situation, Matt Ryan racked up a lot of yards. Julio Jones and Calvin Ridley and their new guy that they got all caught nine passes, all had over 100 yards on the day. That doesn't bother me. If they're playing from behind and racking up those stats, then okay.
Look, Julio and Ridley are awesome. And Gage is actually pretty good. I didn't know much about Gage, but yeah, you know, decent receiver.
Sure.
Now, as far as the defense goes, I don't want to judge them on their performance from about like mid third quarter on.
Right.
Because Ken Norton and Pete did the annoying thing that they always do and just started playing prevent. And it was maddening to watch.
It was annoying.
It was maddening to watch the Falcons go up and down the field. And instead of holding them to just the 18 points that they gave up, and when it actually mattered, they ended up giving up what? What was the final score even? I guess I can't even remember.
38-25.
Okay. I thought it was 24. All right. So there we go. 25. Yeah. And it's statistically, now the defense is going to look terrible, and that's annoying. But let's talk about the defense. I want to focus on the defense for a fair amount in this podcast, because everything I've been hearing all over the internet is all about the offense of Russell Wilson and the receivers and DK and da 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 da. And that's all fine and dandy, but barely anybody's talking about what the defense actually did in this game. Let's start with the first quarter, man. Like, I am alarmed at how they were able to rush Gurley up the gut with such effectiveness early. It was pathetic.
It was. It was three straight plays. And then after that, you didn't really see all that much of Todd Gurley, did you? They went out there, found out that they could apparently have success running him, and then they just went away from it.
So let me ask you a question, Brandon. Did the Seahawks make a defensive adjustment to stop Todd Gurley in the running game?
I don't know.
The answer is no. You know who stopped Todd Gurley in the running game? Russell Carrington Wilson.
Yeah.
By getting up a few scores so that they abandoned the running game. And that's the thing is, like, you look at it like, oh, okay, well, they shored up the run defense, you know, after that first quarter. Not really. They just forced Atlanta to abandon the run. So I'm still very concerned about what this run defense is going to look like. I said it in the offseason that I'm concerned less about the pass rush and more about their ability to stop the run, especially up the middle. And it did not look good early when the Falcons actually had the opportunity to do it.
I think part of the reason, though, why it is standing out so much is just because of how bad it was on those first few plays. And I know that Gurley finished the game with 14 carries. So where did those other carries come from? 56 yards on, he probably had 40 yards on those first three carries. So they did something. They were at least able to bring him down a little more quickly than on the first series.
Oh, it's true. And the Falcons, for some reason, started to run towards the perimeter a lot more, you know, after that first quarter. I still don't understand that move. But yeah, it was interesting. And then we're talking about the DBs and people kind of wringing their hands over, oh, they got torched a little bit. Well, look, all right. Like I said, Julio and Calvin Ridley, hell of receivers. They're good receivers. It's the first game that those guys are all out there working together, Dunbar, Shaq, Quandre, Adams, and Flowers. So you got to expect that there's going to be some communication issues. The one thing that really kind of did bother me, though, is they played so much off coverage, even early.
Yeah.
When did Pete Carroll abandon press coverage? Like, when did this happen? Like, 3 years ago?
That's a good question, because this seems like the kind of team, especially on Ridley. Now, maybe you want to not go right into press with Dunbar on Julio right away, like give him some space. It seemed like Dunbar was giving Julio an awful lot of space and even getting juked out on one of Julio's catches that he thought Julio was moving toward the sideline. And then he just settled down in the zone and Dunbar got beat pretty badly. But yeah, I don't know why Shaq on Ridley, especially why you don't play a little tighter coverage.
It drives me crazy. Just get your hands on him, disrupt the route, disrupt the timing. I mean, it does. It drives me absolutely insane. And then the thing about Dunbar, though, is that if you go back and you look at his Washington days, he does play a lot of off coverage. That's the way he plays.
It was, yeah.
So that's something apparently we're just going to have to live with. I'm not excited about it. What did you think about, there was a lot of like nickel and dime situations where it looked like we had all the safeties in the league on the field at the same time.
That was one of the things that surprised me the most, was just how much I saw Lane O'Hill's jersey number out there on the field. Now, there were a couple negative plays from Hill, but one thing that jumped out at me in terms of the number of receptions and yards allowed, it was that one big play by Lane O'Hill down the field to Julio, where he got behind him a little bit. But other than that, he didn't allow too many yards going his direction. He made some good plays out there. I'm not ready to crush the fact that he was out there yet, but I just about can't stand the fact that we get these guys hyped up through the preseason, and Marquise Blair didn't really stand out to me in terms of making plays.
Maybe not making plays. He had some nice hits. I think he brought a toughness out there.
He so did. Yeah, late in the game when they were really laying the wood toward the end of the game, I liked the fact that they were still hitting hard toward the end of the fourth quarter. And I did see Blair, both Blair and Hill, making some big hits late in the game.
It looks to me that Blair's the dime or the nickelback.
Right.
And Hill is our dime cornerback.
That's
kind of what I was getting out of that.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to really track it, but that was kind of my sense. I think on balance, Lano Hill played okay. People are kind of killing him. The one that he gave up to Julio, he stumbled.
Yeah.
He stumbled. You know, sometimes you stumble when you're trying to run fast with a, you know, a freak of nature like Julio Jones. It happens.
It does happen. So, yeah, like you said, I'm not going to completely crush him. Just looking at snap counts for the defensive backs, Jamal Adams was the only one out there for the entire 79 snaps. I guess Griffin came off the field for one snap, so he had all of them but one. Quandre Diggs out there for a majority of them, 77 snaps. Dunbar had 68. You had Marquise Blair out there for 56. So again, a good portion of it. And then 30 snaps for Delano Hill. So that's a little bit surprising that it was going to be that high of a number. Trey Flowers out there for 11. So they did go defensive back heavy in that second half. And that kind of makes sense considering just how far ahead they were, and they knew that really Atlanta wasn't going to be rushing at that point in the game.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a sensical adjustment that the Seahawks made as far as personnel. I think that the DBs did just fine. I loved the way that Adams and Wagner feed off one another.
Yeah.
Like that, it seems like Adams has brought back a little more fire out of Wags. And I love that because Bobby laid the wood to people in this game.
He did. Yeah. The two guys on defense that definitely jumped off the screen were Bobby Wagner and Jamal Adams, just the entire game. And yeah, I think there's a different kind of energy there for sure that you're picking up on.
Yeah. And it kind of permeated the whole defense. I mean, you know, just like Mayoa, I enjoyed the way that he played. I mean, he really did. That's as much as I think you're going to get out of Benson Mayoa on a game-to-game basis. If you get that kind of production from him, you know, week in, week out, and I'm not talking about the sack, right?
Right.
I mean, I'm just talking the energy and the pressure and all that. I think that's a win. One of the things I was a little disappointed in is didn't really feel Bruce Irvin out there. He had one nice tackle for loss on Gurley. But other than that, I mean, it just, I watched him one-on-one a lot, and he just didn't win at all.
He did have the two quarterback hits, so tied with Adams with that regard. But he wasn't a guy that I was really focused on in terms of the defense because I was trying to watch so much of the new guys, especially on the defensive line. And it was hard to take my eyes off Jamal Adams. So that it's not where my eyes went was to Bruce Irvin.
Speaking of new guys on the defensive line, why the hell was Alton Robinson a scratch?
Why was that? Because we heard about Alton Robinson being an amazing guy in practice, and you would have thought that with the defensive line depth that they would have needed. Now, we heard Pete talk about how it was a matchup-based decision going into the game. And so with all of the need for defensive backs, I think, with the Falcons, that maybe he just was that last guy on the defensive line that he said, okay, we can't bring this many linemen into the game, and that's why he was a scratch. But that was really surprising to me. Who do you leave off the defense then? I guess Ugo Amadi only had one snap in this game in the secondary, so maybe he's the one guy that ends up getting the scratch at this point. But other than that, you know, Nico Thorpe for special teams, he was only out there for one snap on the defensive side. I don't know who you necessarily leave off.
How many snaps did Collier have?
Collier had 30 snaps. So he was on the field just as much as Rasheem Green and Delano Hill.
It must have just been coincidence then, because every time I happened to think, hey, let's watch LJ on this play.
And he
wasn't in. And I was like, what, did he just get benched? Like, you know, like what happened?
I wonder if he played a majority of the first half, because I think you're right. He may not have been out there a ton. And that's another guy that I was disappointed I didn't see more of, and that's Rasheem Green. He was the guy I was expecting to take a little bit bigger of a step in this season, and there's still a lot of time. But, you know, again, it goes back to you knew where Matt Ryan was going to be. You knew he was throwing the ball. You couldn't beat your dude.
Yeah, it happened over and over again. But I'd say if I had to grade this defense on this one game, I'd give him a middling grade, like a C+. And honestly, compared to last year, that's an upgrade. And I don't think that they're going to get worse as the season goes on. you know, I definitely believe in Pete Carroll's ability to develop a team throughout the season. They never, well, the record is decent in the first part of the year. If you really go back over the Pete Carroll era, it does always feel like they start slow. They're not as good as you would hope. You know, they struggle with the likes of a Cincinnati, that sort of thing.
Can we talk about another place then where I saw some growth from, a place where we've been calling on Pete Carroll to show growth over the years and not quite getting there? Can we talk about the screen game? There was a screen game on offense, Adam. It led to one of the first touchdowns in the game.
Rushing quarterbacks, we'll tell you about that, but here's a quick pass. Carson, left side, 10, 5, touchdown, Seahawks! Chris Carson making it look easy down the left side. Russell Wilson with a little flare pass to the left. Carson takes it untouched. And all Dan Quinn can do, the coach of the Falcons, is look up at the big screen and say, what just happened? I'll tell you what happened. A screen pass left side and a gauntlet of blockers for Chris Carson down the left side. And the Seahawks take a 13-3 lead.
Yeah, that was exciting. We've been calling on him to run a lot more screen passes for years. We all know that's not Russell's best pass because, listen, he is a god amongst men and we all love him and we all worship him the way that we properly should, but he is shorter. Uh-huh. And so when you release the defensive lineman and you have them run at him and he has to get the ball up and down over those defensive ends or those defensive linemen that quickly, it's just a difficult throw for him.
It is.
And I think he clearly worked on that this offseason. And I think you know the exact drill that he used to help him with that.
Didn't they have like dudes with holding up big like broomsticks around him or something like that?
No. I was thinking of the one where he was standing in front of the soccer goal and getting it up and down over the soccer goal.
Okay. Real quick. Yeah, there was that one too. Yeah. I thought he was a little bit farther back for that one though.
Well, he runs backwards a long ways for these screens, just to, you know, so maybe it's about the same.
Well, he's got all kinds of drills that probably stuff that we haven't even seen. So I do think that you're right on target with that, though. It's something that he worked on. And I think it was an important way to get Chris Carson involved outside of, you know, just handing it off to him. Because if you combine those six runs by Carson with his six catches, you know, you're getting Carson involved pretty well. And I think you do want to split time with Carlos Hyde. As much as I wanted them to put it away, just pounding the ball right up the middle, I wasn't completely disappointed with the way that the running backs performed in this game.
Oh, not at all. When they had their opportunities, I think both Hyde and Carson looked good, especially Carson with the way that he caught the ball. I mean, that one hand stab that he made, that was
nice.
It was fantastic. Really great play by him all the way around with the opportunities that he had. Now, I'm 100% with you. I would have loved to see them. I guess here's what I'm kind of getting at overall when I said, I'm not sure I like this. And I have conflicting feelings on it and I haven't settled on it and it's just one game and I'm not saying anything was certainty here, but let's talk about some of the things I did like about this offensive approach. With the fact that they were throwing the ball as much as they did it in a bunch of different ways, you know, with the screen game, the quick game, long ball, intermediate routes, option routes, smoke screens, just all sorts of different things in the passing game. It was very multiple. It wasn't like that 2015 run that Russ went on at the end of the season where it was all the quick passing game and that's it. So yeah, you know, play action, boots, the whole thing. And so that gives me some confidence going forward that it won't just be a flash in the pan for a half of a season, that they're able to kind of light people up like this because of the diversity that Schottenheimer introduced into the passing game. Now, I do wish that they would throw early like they did, get up quick, and then pound the
catfish
out of the rock and just take the will of people away from them. And then when you get to that second half, I mean, now you're up five scores because they just quit playing instead of three.
Yeah.
And I think that would be the recipe that marries together the, you know, establish the run, pound the rock, wear people down philosophy that I personally subscribe to. And the, you know, the whole let Russ cook thing. Yeah. I think that would appease everybody. I actually think it would be a way that in the modern NFL, it would work well.
I think part of the problem was when they started running the ball when they're up multiple scores in the second half, they seemed to do it toward the edges. And when you have two power backs like Chris Carson and Carlos Hyde, run between the tackles in those situations. Why are you trying to get outside and get cute?
Maybe they just didn't feel like the offensive line was getting that push, which kind of brings me to the offensive line. I mean, let's talk about those guys for a minute. Like, I thought that if you're going to look at it for the entirety of the game, they played pretty well. They weren't perfect. Yeah. There were issues. It's week one. We all went into this season super excited to get rid of the two drives a game that Jermaine Ifedi just totally blew up on his own. And then Damian Lewis came to the team and said, hold my beer, watch this.
Yeah, Damian Lewis, his penalty issues were what jumped out the most to me along the offensive line. He also allowed the most pressures on the day. He had 4 pressures allowed. No QB hits that were attributed to him. Only 4 quarterback hits for the Falcons in this game. One from Dwayne Brown, 1 Brandon Schell. Will Disley, he got blown up on the end in one play. Upati was credited with 1. And then Russell took the 2 sacks on the day. So I think this is a performance that I could live with if they get the penalty issues squared away. And the penalties, when it came, gosh, they all came together. I can think of 2 of the ugliest series for the Seahawks in this game, and both ended up actually working out pretty well. The one was where they got the penalty. It was 1st and 5, and then they end up, I don't even remember what they did on first.
I don't remember the sequence either, but I remember looking at my buddy in the hotel room and just being like, yeah, remember how we just started out at 1st and 5? Now it's 4th and 5.
Now it's 4th and 5. This happened.
At the 38-yard line. Let's see if he does, in fact, go forward. Russell, 4th down and 5. He is. 4-man rush. Russ looks. He's going to lay it up over the top. He's got a man down there. It's Metcalf. He's got it. Touchdown, Seahawks. On 4th down and 5, Russ takes the snap, stands back there like a patient man and waits, and 14 gets open for 6. A 38-yarder. Holy smoke. You guys are covering DK Metcalf with 1 man. Forget about it. He beats him for 6.
Yeah, we got the Wyman chuckles.
I have to say, for all our listeners, the highlight that the Seahawks put out cut it off right at the end of Rabel's call there. It didn't have any Wyman in there. So I had to go back and go through the full audio of the game just so I could get the Wyman chuckle in at the end of that highlight. I thought it was important.
This is why you're going to be podcaster of the year, Brandon. It's this attention to detail that's amazing.
And I have to let everybody know about it.
Poor Oliver, man. That DB. He tries to jam him. That's hilarious. And then and DK, that was a... I know it's a fly route. And people are like, oh, you just run straight. It's not what he did at all, man. Like, he gets him... He gets jabbed. He shakes that. And he starts to bend it inside just a little bit, just so that he can bend it back and stack him. Mm-hmm. And then he's got him by 2 steps, and Russ was just licking his chops. It was a thing of beauty. That's what makes DK Metcalf special right there. I mean, the speed, the power, and now his route running and attention to detail that way. Just amazing. The drops were a bummer. The one was egregious.
The other one,
he should have had that. Like, you catch that. But right. We've talked about it on the pod before. He's not a natural catcher of the football. That's just not who he is. We're going to have to live with some of that with him. I think I will. I have no problems with that.
Another thing that I'm not sure matters or not, that I know a lot of people calling for Pete Carroll to go for it more on 4th down. And we did see an opportunity before this 4th and 5 touchdown pass to DK Metcalf where they passed it up. They're right around midfield. They only had about 2 yards to go. I thought it was a good situation where they went ahead and punted. And for people thinking that this is a change in Pete Carroll philosophy, in this particular situation where it's 4th and 5, they were looking at a 53-yard field goal. And we know that that's just a touch outside of Jason Myers' range. We've seen Pete Carroll outdoors decide to punt it when it's been in a similar situation as this. So I don't think we could take anything away from the fact that Pete decided to go for it in this particular situation, because this is where Pete Carroll is probably about 50-50 on going for it anyway on fourth down. So I don't know if this necessarily represents a shift in Pete Carroll's philosophy.
I can't remember which one of the little flockers posted it in the Ring of Honor. The picture of Russ looking at the sidelines after they stopped him on third.
Yeah. And celebrating.
I wish I could give credit to who that was, because I just can't remember it off the top of my head. But it was hilarious, because the whole thing that you heard in the press conference is that they were celebrating like they just won the Super Bowl. And Russ was like, oh, no, we're going after him now. In that look, I don't think Pete Carroll had a choice about philosophy in the moment. Russ had a philosophy, and it was, I'm going to tear your heart out for that
catfish.
Yeah, it was Dave Bloomquist that picked up on that and posted the screenshot. So that was the moment, and that really was, I think, the moment where you said to yourself, this is the Seahawks game now.
Yeah, and what was really fun about that, too, and the score was close at that point as well. I mean,
14-12 at that point.
And the other thing is that I heard Pete say Russ had options on that play. Mm. And the option Russ chose was all of it. He was taking all of it. And I love that about Russ. He's done this before. I think he hit D Moore on a play like that before. He's done that numerous times.
I think he tried it against the Ravens and just missed last season.
He's got the big ones when it comes to those situations. Like, he has no problems going for it all.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the other new guys on the team. The best showing by an offseason acquisition. I got to give it to Greg Olsen. I liked seeing the big tight end. It was confusing with him wearing 88 because I kept thinking it was Will Dissly early on. But Olsen had the touchdown grab, which was pretty clutch. The fact that he just turned out of his break and there the ball was, like, in his at his chest. It was a good catch.
You are unbelievable, Brandon. Not all big white tight ends look the same.
He's wearing Disley's number from last year.
No, but it was fun watching Greg Olsen out there. And that throw from Russ was awesome. I mean, it really was. It was on Greg Olsen before he had a chance to even blink, man. Like, the fact that he caught that is actually kind of spectacular. One of the things that I noticed, and I don't know if you did either, Brandon, but Russ's throwing motion looks a tiny bit different to me.
I didn't pick up on it.
It's not quite as over the top. He's kind of slinging it from the side a little bit more. A little bit more Rodgers-y.
Yeah, if you're talking about Russell Wilson and his... Not necessarily throwing it over the top, but going sidearm on one play. That was probably my favorite Russell Wilson play of the game, getting away from Tack McKinley and then hitting David Moore, who got down to about the 2-yard line.
Third down and two. Russell, play fake. Being chased. Look out. Makes one man miss. Sidearms a throw. Ball is caught by Moore. First down. 5-4-3. Knocked off his feet at the 2. David Moore almost gets there. Russell Wilson just avoiding being sacked. Sidearms a throw to David Moore, who turned up the field, up the sidelines for 18 yards, all the way down to about the 2.5-yard line. Tack McKinley says, oh, I have him. No, I don't. And a nice sidearm throw, and the Seahawks in position to really salt this one away.
And one of the reasons why it was one of my favorites is because it was on third down. They didn't do a whole lot on third down in this game, only 3 of 9. And that's probably one of the areas where you hope that they can get better in these games coming up. They're going to need to get better, being 1 of 1 on a fourth down. That helped too. But that play, yeah, and then seeing Carlos Hyde get in the end zone not too long after that, that was one of my favorite plays of the game.
Oh, it was vintage Russ. I mean, third down, got to have it. You know, makes a guy miss.
Ducks under the arm of McKinley.
You know, and off platform, it doesn't matter, you know, which foot he's on, like which way his body's twisted. You know, it just doesn't matter. Just slings it in there. I mean, it's him, Mahomes, and Rodgers. Like, those are the three dudes that can do that with consistency. And that's it. And that's all.
And it's one of my favorite things to watch. Now, there's one thing I think just reminded me that we didn't get to when we talked about the defense. Can we give them some credit for keeping the Falcons 0-for-4 on fourth down in this game? That was huge.
Yeah, it was huge. And I mean, and also too, I mean, I guess the one turnover was on special teams, you know, but Blair, defensive player, created the turnover, and then Diggs with the interception, two turnovers on the day, and it's all about the ball. You know, as a whole, for a season opener on the road early on, no fans, which everybody seemed to make a big freaking deal out of, a solid performance, you know, enough for us all to feel good about, you know, where the team's starting out from and going into week two. I just didn't want to get as high as I've heard everybody else kind of talk about this. And, you know, kind of point out that there's a lot of areas for improvement. You mentioned the third down conversions, and we'd heard all through camp how proficient they had been on third downs and in the red zone. As far as third downs goes, it just didn't show up in this game. They're going to need that when they take on the Patriots.
Let's talk about this game coming up against the Patriots, because watching them against the Dolphins this last week, I don't necessarily have a lot to go off of in terms of their new offense. It was two very different halves of football. Watching Cam against the Dolphins in the first half, it seemed like it was read option the entire first half, and then they let him throw the football a little bit in the second half, and they moved the ball pretty well. But when you talk about defensive lines, in 2019, it was the Dolphins' defensive line that was often compared to the Seahawks as being among the worst five in the NFL. So the fact that they weren't getting to Cam in this game, part of it has me concerned, because if we haven't improved the way that the Dolphins haven't improved, then it could be a rough go for our Seahawks defense. But I think that in terms of the secondary, I have a hard time thinking that Cam passing the ball is going to be able to move the ball as well as he did against the Dolphins.
Yeah, it's clear that they're going to limit Cam to throwing the intermediate routes down the seams. Like that's pretty much his bread and butter. It's what he does well, and that's where they want to live, is middle of the field, intermediate routes. Mm-hmm. And like you said, the first half, it was a crap ton of read option. And if I know Bill Belichick even just a little bit, he knows that the run defense did not look good early, and the Falcons just like let it go. I don't anticipate that being the case in week two. We're going to find out a lot about what this defense is going to be able to do against a heavy dose of the run. It's coming. Because if you're Bill Belichick, why are you going to go against the strength of the Seattle defense? Why? When you can go against a weaker part of it.
And he's going to test that early. And if it continues to work, he's going to continue to run the ball. That's just the way he is. That's the way he was against the Dolphins. He doesn't care if he wins the game by, you know, a score of 14-10. As long as he gets the win, he doesn't care what people think if Cam's throwing the football enough. And, you know, you brought up the idea of Cam's favorite routes. It definitely, looking at the next gen stat chart, have you seen that?
No, this was just me watching the game and trying to, you know, pick up what I could.
Do you remember how many throws of 15 plus yards he had in that game?
No, I can't recall.
One. He had one throw over 15 yards in that game, and it was an incomplete pass. And I think it was Edelman who got blown up as he was trying to get it, and he just couldn't hang on to it. But yeah, he only threw it beyond the sticks three times, and those were completions. But yeah, everything toward the middle of the field, nothing toward the sideline, like no completions toward the sideline, which was really interesting to me. And the reason why the one downfield pass stood out to me is that it looked like Cam needed a lot of effort with his arm just to get it 20 yards down the field. And so I'm curious if Cam is back in terms of his arm strength.
I didn't get that impression. I thought his arm strength looked fine.
It looked good on those intermediate throws. I agree. But yeah.
Well, he's never been a great deep ball thrower.
No.
Ever. He doesn't have that kind of touch. And then the reason he doesn't throw outside a lot, because McDaniels isn't a stupid guy, is that he knows that Cam doesn't throw with great anticipation. You got to get rid of that ball early on those outbreaking routes. Otherwise, guys undercut him and it's a pick six. Mm-hmm. So they're just not going to let him do that. I find it hilarious that everybody is applauding Pete Carroll for abandoning the run and, you know, letting Russ throw the ball 1,000 times, and oh, they finally got with the times. And then the Bill brings in Cam, and everybody loses their
catfish
and says, what a genius they are for taking Cam Newton and running a bunch of read option and literally coming out on their first 5 or 6 plays and just cramming it down the Dolphins' throat. Then everybody's like, oh, look at that. That's so genius. Well, he sits there and establishes the run so he can throw the ball a little bit more in the second half and then wins the game. Bill Belichick's a genius, but when Pete Carroll does it for years, he's a dinosaur.
Yeah, that part of this game was not lost on me. The fact that Belichick was, you know, the dinosaur in this game and doing it his way and didn't take any flack for it because they got the win. Now, Russell Wilson at his point in his career, a little bit different at where Cam is at his point in his career right now. But gosh, if the Seahawks can't get pressure on Cam Newton the way that Miami couldn't get pressure on him, they only recorded pressure at him on 4 of his 22 dropbacks. They had 2 sacks, and then he had 1 completion on those 4 pressured dropbacks. Everything else, he had all the time in the world to find his guys, which was usually Edelman. If it wasn't Edelman, it was N'Keal Harry. And if it wasn't that, he was just checking down to whatever running back was on the field.
Just be prepared mentally for that exact same thing to happen this weekend. It's just a matter if the Seahawks can then outscore them. And it's not like the Patriots put up a ton of points in that game. So, yeah, that's on the table. But
they should have had 4 touchdowns in that game because it was N'Keal Harry that reached out over the goal line, did the fumble through the end zone instead of holding on to the football. And I'm sure Belichick was pretty pissed at him about that.
Yeah.
But yeah. They should have handily dealt with Miami. And most of that really, I think, came in the second half where they were moving the football and taking advantage of the Fitzpatrick turnover in the first half.
Yeah, Fitzpatrick had a rough day. But then again, Bill Belichick has been torturing Ryan Fitzpatrick for decade plus now, whether that's been with the Bills or with the Jets or with the Dolphins or any of his rivals in the AFC East that Fitzpatrick has started for. Bill Belichick has tortured that poor bastard. Now, the thing is, when you look traditionally over the years, Pete and Bill have matched up very well here during Pete Carroll's era with the Seahawks, and Bill Belichick has not been able to befuddle Russell Wilson. It hasn't happened.
Yeah, the regular season matchups definitely have gone the way of the Seahawks generally, and I'm hoping that continues to be the case here that's coming up on Sunday.
You and me both, but I also want to prepare all the 12s out there, especially for the Let Russ Cookers, that you're probably going to be disappointed this weekend.
It's not going to be like it was against Atlanta.
No. Patriots have one of the best secondaries in football.
Right.
Again, why would you throw into the teeth of that when their weakness is the fact that they lost linebackers due to COVID and their opt-outs and a defensive line that really doesn't have anybody that's a star?
No.
They're going to try to pound the rock in this game. And everybody's going to be like, oh, Pete Carroll just did that for a week and now he's regressed. No, he looked at the matchups, dumbass.
But don't you think that Belichick is looking at the matchups too and he's saying, okay, I think I'm going to show on the defensive side of the ball more advantageous looks for Russell where Russell and Pete Carroll are going to want to run the ball more against the looks that he's given on the defense because he doesn't want to get beat by Russell Wilson either.
No, but Russ will figure that out. He's always figured it out against Belichick. I mean, Russ is at that point in his career where you can't just confuse him. This isn't like Peyton Manning for those first 8 years when Belichick would just torture him.
Yeah.
Right. Like that. That's not how that's worked with Russ.
Let's be clear. There's not a ton of history of Pete Carroll and Bill Belichick. There was the 2012 game, which is notorious for Richard Sherman getting in Tom Brady's face. Then there was the Super Bowl. And then there was the game where in 2016, that was, I think, the CJ ProSize one good game.
It was. Yeah, it was one of his 2. Yeah. Yeah. But so, that's my point.
It's not a huge history.
Brandon, once is a coincidence, twice is a trend, 3 times is a Bill Belichick problem.
It is. It's going to be a problem for him. Things that I'm going to watch for in this game is, just apart from where Stephon Gilmore is on the field at any given time, he is their one good player. on defense. You mentioned the fact the guys that opted out. Dante Hightower, one of their best players at linebacker. Patrick Chung, he opted out. I think everybody else was on the offensive side of the ball. So but Hightower being the big one. Are they going to be able to cover up the Seahawks receivers as well as they did with the Dolphins? Because one thing that I noticed watching that game is that Fitzpatrick was having to throw into small windows just about the entire day.
Well, Devontae Parker, wasn't there, and that was a big problem.
Yeah.
So and he's basically their one guy that they have that you really look at and think that he's pretty gifted. I mean, I definitely say Tyler Lockett will get his, but I kind of look for the tight ends to kind of bust out a little bit in this game. That's kind of what I'm thinking. Take advantage of that linebacking crew and their inexperience, and that's kind of where I would target if I were shoddy.
I like that. And it's unfortunate that we didn't talk more Tyler Lockett before this point, because it was clear on a couple of those drives who Russell's favorite target still was. And when he was connecting with Tyler just down the field against the Falcons, that was fun to watch.
Yeah. So I was kind of taking the approach of not talking about Tyler so that when the Patriots listen to this podcast, because you know they will, they do all that, right? Like all the spying they can.
Nobody prepares better than the Patriots.
Yeah, nobody
They've
does
listened
something
to
better
every
than the
single
Patriots.
Seahawks podcast there is going into this game.
You think that doesn't happen? I think it probably does. I didn't want to talk about Noe because I thought it's a lot like when people ask me about Montana. Is it beautiful? No, it sucks. It's cold. Like we still got our male Pony Express. It's terrible. Yeah. You don't want to be there. Same thing with Lockett. It was fine. You don't need to worry about it. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about Tyler. He's not worth your concern.
I'm totally reverse psychologizing Bill Belichick right now.
Yeah.
And he's probably in his office right now being like, I knew exactly what you were doing anyway. So
there's your one other good impression. You can do Trump and you can do Belichick. Those are your two that you've got in your holster.
I can do others.
We'll see about that.
Yeah.
Keys to this game. Can you cover Julian Edelman? Can you not be terrible at defending the read option the way the Dolphins were? And I do feel like that the Seahawks can be better at that. I know it's been a while since Russ has done it, and Cam is really good at running the read option. And can Russell Wilson find the open dudes in the secondary?
Well, if you're Ken Norton, I'll tell you exactly what you need to do, the tape you need to study. And everybody told me I was crazy back in the day when I talked about this, but it's a true fact. Josh McDaniels is running the Tim Tebow offense with Cam Newton. And I said it back in the day. I said, if anybody ever committed to it and they ran all that power with Tebow back there and then just let him pop, 10 passes that are more down the field where he has time to wind up and let it rip, that Tebow would have been a successful quarterback in this league, especially in a league when the whole league is geared to defend the pass. If you just jellied it down their throat, running power like a single wing thing with the quarterback, you'd have success, and nobody ever did it. Now he's doing it with Cam Newton, and now suddenly he's a genius. They do it with Lamar Jackson. Now suddenly John Harbaugh's a genius. Josh McDaniels is running the Tim Tebow playbook.
And now, it's been long enough that I don't think people even remember that Tim Tebow played in the NFL.
Not true. There's still the Tebow cult out there. Somebody somewhere right now, I promise you, is Tebowing in this very moment, just by the sheer mention of his name.
Oh, well, I'm going to Tebow as we go into this break, Adam, and come back and we'll still see if I'm still Tebowing.
Well, fantastic. Then you will have a blessed second half.
Getting into the second half of the show, I want to talk a little NFC West, Adam, because you know what? I should start off.
I know exactly how you should start off, Brandon.
By saying how wrong I am about...
No, by saying, suck it, Niners.
Yes, yes. That is exactly where I wanted to start off, because I was wrong about the San Francisco 49ers, Adam. I said that there were two tiers in the NFC West. It was the Seahawks and Niners, and then the bottom tier, it was the Rams and Cardinals, and I had that wrong. It is the Rams and 49ers that are the bottom tier, and the Cardinals and Seahawks in the top tier now, because what I saw from...
Will you get this right? You just need to get this right, because you're still wrong.
Okay.
There are two tiers. There are the Niners, the Rams, and the Cards, and then there's the Seahawks. Now you have it correct.
Now I have the two tiers.
Yes.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. But The other thing that I got wrong was where we ranked Jimmy Garoppolo in terms of the quarterbacks within the NFC West, because I think I had him rated above Jared Goff. And in this offseason, we played a clip from, I can't even remember who his name was, but we played a clip and this guy nailed the quarterback rankings. Jimmy Garoppolo is in last place by far.
Garoppolo is the worst quarterback in the NFC West, and that division has Jared Goff and Chance the Rapper Jr.
The Chance the Rapper Jr. is pretty good.
It is.
That's actually pretty hilarious. I'm not sure that Garoppolo is worse than Goff. Like, did you actually think Goff played well this weekend?
No, I thought that Garoppolo looked like a 40-year-old quarterback that was afraid to get hit the entire game.
Okay, so yes, he doesn't like to get hit at all, for sure. And you actually hit the nail on the head with a text to me over the weekend that Jimmy G never steps into a throw. And it's something I'd noticed. And it's actually something I'd heard Chris Sims talk about when he did his quarterback rankings coming into this year about how he throws flat footed all the time. It's all arm and he doesn't get his hips through. And so his accuracy suffers. It's a major problem. And you'll watch him when he gets into the pocket and he'll drop back and watch his cleats just go, just smack down flat into the ground. And he stands there completely flat footed and then just guns it. You know who his footwork looks like?
Who?
Cutler.
Okay. Cutler had better arm strength, though.
That's just it. He actually had arm talent. Jimmy G doesn't.
Oh, I had in my notes here, we had a discussion about Greg Olsen being worthy of the Hall of Fame, and I think you said something about Frank Gore.
He's the Frank Gore tight ends of his generation.
Yeah, and you're wrong about that. I went and Jason Witten is the Frank Gore of tight ends of our generation.
Yeah, in the broadcast in this last game, didn't they say that during the time he's played, he's like third in receptions or yards or something along that nature? It was something high like that. I remember hearing Schlereth bring it up and I was like, ha, told you.
Yeah. He's number two in receiving yards among all tight ends, only behind Tony Gonzalez.
Greg Olsen or Witten?
Witten.
Well, yeah. I'm talking about Greg Olsen still.
Oh, Greg Olsen. Gosh.
No, during his time period, Schlereth dropped one. He was like,
can you not say Schlereth?
It's Schlereth. That's how he says his name.
Oh, okay.
I can say Schlereth.
That doesn't sound right to me.
All right, then let's just agree on stink.
Who are we talking about? Greg Olsen for
Mark Schlereth. Schlereth said something along the lines of during his time in the league, out of all the tight ends, he's like second in receptions or third or yards or something like that. It was impressive. It was a compiler number, much like Frank Gore.
Oh, well, okay. So in this generation of tight ends, if it's Jason Witten, number one with yards, Antonio Gates, number two, and then Greg Olsen would be number three.
And there you go.
Yeah. But I think
still not wrong.
I think Witten and Gates go in the Hall of Fame and Greg Olsen, unfortunately, doesn't make it.
I didn't say he'd be first ballot.
Oh, because Gronk's got to get in, too.
Yeah. I'm not saying he's first ballot. I'm just saying at some point they'll let him in.
You know, there's only eight.
Just for his jawline.
He has. Yeah, he'd be first ballot Hall of Fame if you go off jawline.
So I have a theory that Greg Olsen is actually a clone of Leif Erikson, the Viking. I think he is literally like direct DNA from the Vikings.
Do you think that Fitzpatrick would be like his distant cousin?
I think that they have definitely sailed up a river in a flat bottom boat and destroyed and pillaged a village or two together. I think that's happened.
Yeah. Once both these guys are retired, I want a Viking show where Greg Olsen and Ryan Fitzpatrick are the two lead actors in it.
So Fitzpatrick would have to be the king and like Greg Olsen would be like the warrior that can't be defeated and just whips ass.
Yeah, like his heavy.
Yeah, because I could see like Fitz with his like sparkly eyes, like, you know, like, you know, scheming things up, right? Uh-huh. Like, yeah. Game of Thrones and things.
With his Harvard brain.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Man, somebody in LA, like, hit us up. We got a show for you.
I think I'm on this because have you watched Norseman on Netflix?
I have not. Jared tried to get me into Vikings as well. It was a little too cheesy for me.
Oh,
but the girlfriend did drag me into The Last Kingdom and on Netflix. And so, yeah, I did watch all of that.
I think Norseman is a spoofy version of the Viking show. And I think it's filmed in Norway.
Where Vikings come from?
And it's very funny.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
It's a comedy?
It's a comedy.
It's a Viking comedy?
Yes.
Didn't see that coming.
Check it out.
Okay.
Thank me later.
All right.
All right. Why do you say we welcome some new members of the flock?
We actually had some?
they apparently like the show for some reason.
Yeah, well, I'll take it.
Maybe it's because of our analysis of jawlines of guys like Greg Olsen and Ryan Fitzpatrick.
I think it's because of my keen eye of recognizing Hall of Fame tight ends.
Bow, chicka, bow, bow.
Yeah.
Welcome to the flock. Young Choi back in. Oh, he went annual. That's why he showed up on my list. He switched over from the 12-12 monthly to the 12-12 annually. Oh, and he says, oh my gosh, I suck at life worse than Skip Bayless. My credit card got compromised and it took me this long to realize that I've been freeloading. And instead of being a little flocker, I've become a little
catfisher.
Please forgive me and go Hawks.
Yeah, you don't want to be a little
catfisher.
No.
No. But yeah, appreciate that, Young.
Young's always helping us out. He doesn't have to worry about becoming a little
catfisher.
Yeah, I think he's well established. His hawker's clean.
Yeah, don't you worry about your hawker, Young.
Yeah.
Michael Schumacher came in with a $50 donation via PayPal. Thanks to Michael. Welcome to the flock.
Yeah, thanks, man. And congratulations on all those driving championships, man. You were awesome.
It may not be that Michael Schumacher. The F1 legend. F1 legend, yes. Michael Schumacher is a Seahawks fan.
Go Hawks.
I bet you Michael has probably never heard that either. The
I know, reference and it to doesn't it. Matter. It was for everybody else, and I know it annoyed him, so I'm kind of sorry. Jack, hey, Adam, where's Eve?
Right. Yeah.
Never heard it.
Never heard it?
No.
Nathan DeVos came in at $5 a month for a full year. He threw it all in annually. So a big welcome to the flock and thank you to Nathan.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, coming from the DeVos family, he's got the money for it. So appreciate it.
Spelled differently, but yeah.
Oh, well, okay. Well, then he's not loaded. So that was a big donation. Thanks, man.
$38 from Andrew in Tacoma, says Adam and Brandon. My guys, we are off to a flying start. I'll start with a
catfish.
The Falcons. Damn bird watchers.
Who?
Life sucks right now for most of us, but the Hawks are making life that much better for us flockers. I can call myself a flocker after my $38 donation in respect to that glorious win. The last thing I want to be is a freeloader. Holy
catfish!
You guys put on such a fantastic show. Thank you for that. First listen to your 300th episode with Steve Rabel, and I was hooked. As a Hawks fan, I find what most people find annoying is my undying loyalty and optimism every season. If you ask me, we are going to win it all every year. With that being said, do you fellas want to reassess your projections for our season record now that we see the ceiling this team truly has? I think this is your one chance to do so. And look forward to your discussion. Go Hawks from Andrew in Tacoma.
Well, hey, Andrew, you came in on the 300 show. They're not always that good. So hang in there.
Yeah.
As far as the record prediction, you also missed out on Brandon's usual run through the schedule when we do that, which is predicting 16-0.
Usually, so, yeah. Although, see, now that Andrew's in the flock, maybe he had a chance to go back and listen to our record prediction show, because didn't we both predict 12-4?
Yeah, I think so.
So do we need revise that to what, like 13-3? I don't know, based on the week one.
I don't know. I figured they'd be a 2 seed. Like I think that's pretty good.
I feel like 12-4 is still a pretty good projection. Yeah.
Right.
I'm gonna stick with it.
Okay. How about this? How about I do this for Andrew? I predict that Russell Wilson breaks the single season touchdown mark set by Patrick Mahomes 2 years ago.
Ooh, I would like that. You know, when they announced that Russell was part of that club with Steve Young, You know, the 30,000 and what, 4,000 yards rushing?
Yeah.
I was kind of curious.
It's a two-man club, yeah?
It's a two-man club, but I always like to...
Is that still a club?
I think it's just a couple dudes hanging out when it's just two of you.
I think that's just a hangout. I think you have to have, like, at least four for a club.
Yeah. We have our own club, you and me, as Seahawkers podcast hosts.
Although, if it is just the two of them, if they had a treehouse that they met in, then it can be a club.
Then it could be a club.
Yeah. With just two.
Well, when they do that cutoff, I like to see, you know, who are they leaving off by cutting it off at 30,000 yards and 4,000 and 4,000 rushing yards. McNair would have made it if you would have said 3,500 yards instead of 4,000.
Cunningham? Vic?
Vic only had like 22,000 passing yards. So he was okay. He was way off. But you said
Tarkenton.
You said Cunningham. Yeah. And he had 29,000 passing yards. So he had it for the rushing, but he was 21 yards short of 30,000.
Oh, so he was a Gary Anderson made field goal away from being in the club.
So like on the door of the treehouse of Steve Young and Russell Wilson, it says like no Cunninghams allowed.
The cool kids club, except Randall.
Come back when you throw 21 more yards, Randall.
Yeah. How about Tarkenton?
Tarkenton would have made it if you said 3,500 yards rushing instead of 4,000.
Okay.
And McNabb almost had 3,500,000 yards, or 3,500 yards rushing.
3,500,000 yards. That's a pretty cool number.
100,000 rushing yards for Donovan McNabb. Prolific.
Yeah. No wonder he threw up. He was tired.
I think the cooler club to be a part of would be 300 passing touchdowns and 3,000 rushing yards. There's three guys.
Three dudes. Well, I bet you Steve Young.
You know what? I'm glad that you guessed that, because after Russell throws his next touchdown pass, he'll be tied with Steve Young for career touchdown passes.
Really?
Isn't that surprising?
Well, it is and it isn't, only because Steve Young took so long to become the full-time starter.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true.
Struggled in Tampa for a couple years, and then, you know, Joe Montana held him down. Yeah.
So, no, he did not eclipse 300 passing touchdowns.
Elway?
Okay, you got Elway. It's funny how it lands kind of in three different generations of quarterbacks for these three guys. Elway's one. He's the middle generation.
Okay. Well, then Tarkenton.
Yep. That was the other one. And then there's an active player.
There's an active player. Well, hell's bells. I don't know. I'm drawing a blank.
Aaron Rodgers.
I guess I don't think of Aaron Rodgers as that much of a runner.
Yeah.
A scrambler, yes, in terms of making dudes miss in the pocket, but I just never thought of him as picking up that much on the ground.
Yeah, he has over 3,000 rushing yards already.
That surprises me, to be honest. I would not have guessed that.
I don't know if he's going to make the 4,000-yard club along with Russell and Steve Young.
No, because he's going to be injured in week four this year.
But Cam Newton's going to be there probably by the end of the year. He just needs 800 passing yards to go over 30,000.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I thought I did pretty good with my guesses off the top of the head.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
It was a little fun little break from our Welcome to the Flock segment. We can get back to it now.
Oh, good. Okay. This is why you all pay for that gem. Stuff like that.
DJ in the Flock at 12 a month. I feel like we just had the talk about how many cool DJs we knew, and now you can add DJ to the group.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that there's people with the name DJ and not just people who do DJ. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't think that all the way through. And so DJ brought that to our attention, and now he's a member of the Ring of Honor, and he can shame me endlessly on there.
It's weird how it didn't even occur to you when we were talking about DJ Dallas, and DJ is literally his name.
Right. But the problem is he spells it out. That's why I was so confused.
That is very confusing. Not a lot of DJs do that.
No. And usually it's Dennis Jones, right? It's an abbreviation for that.
Is it?
Yeah. For people's names when they call him DJ.
Okay.
It's true fact. You can look it up in a book.
That's a very random stat that I feel like you know there. I actually never heard that.
I just know things.
12-12 from Nuno Biscaya. Nuno's from Portugal, and he was our winner for the Pick'em League this week. Had 13
really?
Picks right, yeah.
Wow. And he did it in Portugal.
I know. It's pretty
wild. That seems harder somehow.
He's in the future. He's like 8 hours
so
ahead
Nuno's
of us.
So Nuno's a cheater. Yeah. I see how it is.
Although, I think everybody in England is about on the same time zone, so... But John won last year, so maybe there's something to this.
Oh, they're time travelers. They're basically the Philip Dorsetts of the Pick'em League. Traveling through space and time.
Yeah, just about, yeah. And Nuno comes in with a note, says, "Holy catfish! I didn't expect this one. First, let me congratulate you and Adam for the great podcast. It's awesome. Absolutely love it. I've been listening for a couple years. I think this is the right time to cleanse my chakra by making a small donation and stop being a freeloader. What a game this last Sunday. Definitely not used to these normal games where my heart doesn't stop at least a couple times per game. Best wishes all the way from Portugal. Go Hawks." From Nuno.
Go Hawks, Nuno. Yeah. I'm glad that you got that chakra cleanse. I bet it feels good.
Yeah.
You know, you pair that with a win. That's a hard feeling to beat. Nuno's on the top of the world right now. And a week one win in the Pick'em League? Just quit now on life, Nuno. And just because you've peaked. This is it. This is the best week of your life.
We had the tiebreaker set up to be the first one in with their picks, but he didn't even need the tiebreaker. He went 13 picks correct. The only three games he missed were the Dallas game against the Rams. So really he picked that game correctly because he picked the Rams to lose. He picked Indy correct. Over Jacksonville and picked
he picked correctly. Yeah. Only Philip Rivers rivered it.
Just about everybody in the league missed on Philly, Washington, and Indy, Jacksonville.
I don't know what I came in with last week.
I came in with 10. What's your pick'em name?
Dizzly Adams.
Dizzly Adams.
like Grizzly Adams.
Exactly. You had 8 correct.
That doesn't feel right.
You did all right because you're right there with Mrs. Doug Baldwin, Annalisa.
Okay.
Last year's Pick'em champion, John Davison, Toonhawk, he came in with 8.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Which did I miss? Oh, you can't tell.
No, I can tell.
Oh.
I'm just not going to tell you.
No, okay.
You missed Philly, Indy, Minnesota, Green Bay. You picked Miami over New England. Blew that one.
What?
Yeah.
That was accidental.
You picked Detroit over Chicago. Detroit should have had that one.
Yeah.
What was it, Swift, who had the ball in the end zone and just dropped it?
Yeah, yeah.
You picked San Fran to beat Arizona. You picked the Bucks over New Orleans?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you picked Dallas over the Rams.
I should have. I'm not going to pick Tampa again for probably another 3-4 weeks. Till they get it together.
I think the two that I beat you on then was that I picked the Rams and I feel dirty about it. And then I didn't screw up and pick the Dolphins.
I don't know what you need to do, but you're going to have to do something to cleanse your hawker for that one. Gross.
It feels gross.
Good.
The reason why I did it is...
Shower after you're done with this podcast, young man.
I didn't like McCarthy coming back in his first game. That was the only reason.
I was actually really proud of my pick'em name this year. Because it's got the Montana guy.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. And then this was unintentional. I just went with Dizzly Adams. And then I thought about it. I was like, oh, well, we have Adams now. But I was just thinking, it's like, well, my name's Adam. And then I get to cram those two things together. Will Dizzly in my name. Mm-hmm. And then it also works with Jamal Adams. And then also there's grizzly bears here in Montana.
Wow.
So it just works on a lot of levels, and that's probably my best one yet. Very proud.
Hopefully it pays off with your picks later on.
What's yours?
Week. The blue food.
Oh, that's right.
We discussed this.
Yes, I know. I just forgot.
Welcome to the flock to Brandon Bowen in at $5 a month at getintheflock.com.
Yeah, welcome, man.
Spells Brandon wrong, but that's cool.
Nah, it's still right. And so he gets to do the Discord thing.
Yes. Yeah, we've started up the Discord. Discord's our game day chat, the go-to place there. And so if you get in at $3 a month or above, and also if you come in via PayPal, just ask me for an invite. If you come in via PayPal, it should go out automatically for people at gettingtheflock.com. But yes, that is our game day go-to place. So if you can't go in full 12-12, be a part of the Facebook group, at least get in at three and above and be a part of the Discord chat on game day.
Yeah, I was not able to do that this week, but the month of October looks promising, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm a little upset that I got to learn yet another app thing.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I'm not excited.
The cool thing is, and the thing that won me over was Floctimus Prime saying that you don't have to type in /Giphy every time you want to use a GIF, because that's what you had to do in Slack to use a GIF, and you can actually just press a button in Discord to go to the GIF section. And that's what won me over.
I have to learn a whole new app for that.
Also, the channel navigation is way easier.
Oh, okay. That might be better, because the Slack didn't make any damn sense to me.
For whatever reason, Discord, I thought it was really difficult to set up the first time, which is why I didn't do it.
Mm.
And why we went to Slack. But it just integrates well with the gettingtheflock.com, and so that's, I made the switch.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well,
and you know how hard it is for me to try and make a decision, especially when I have to take into account other people's feelings like yours and having to learn new technology.
No, other people's feelings like everybody else's.
Care about your feelings.
You make
too.
You make all sorts of decisions without me, you know, which I don't mind.
Because if I go to you and I ask you about a decision, you'll be like, I don't care. Just make a decision. So that's why I don't ask you about decisions.
Look at how much I've helped you make decisions.
I'm telling you, this has been a good relationship for us.
Yeah, absolutely. We're both growing or not. I don't know.
Volker Garba came in at $4 a month via PayPal. So thank you to Volker.
Yeah, thanks, buddy.
Eric came in at $1 at gettingtheflock.com, $1 a month. So thanks to Eric.
Yeah, man. Are we going to do another set of stickers with the newer revamped logo with the better background and better text and stuff?
Yeah, I think we will, because I'm getting kind of low on stickers. So I'm going to have to redo those here pretty soon.
Okay, because I need to put one on my truck.
Okay.
Because now I'm a truck guy like you.
Nice. We also had a couple raises come in from Anders Rogard, came in and gave us up from $5 to $12.12 a month. You remember Anders.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I noticed that he did. He bumped up. And yep. I thought that was awesome because, I mean, he needed to be in the Ring of Honor. Only well, made sense.
A great time in the pub in London, you know. Mm-hmm. How long ago was that now? Was that just 2 years ago?
I don't know. The COVID year adds 5 years. It's like a dog year.
It definitely feels that way.
Yeah.
Tyler Watt, he gave us a raise up to $3. So Tyler getting in the Discord group.
Sweet. Get your other brothers in here, Tyler.
Like JJ and TJ.
Yeah.
And lastly, a note here from William Rawl. He came in at $3 a month last year, but his note came in after the show. He says, "Hi, lads. I finally bit the bullet after an extended freeloading period and joined the flock. I really do appreciate the time and effort you both put into the podcast. And believe me, it's well worth it. You get me through the night shifts and work with the sarcasm, quick wit, humor, and knowledge of the game and fans. The best part is the look on my work colleagues' faces when they see me laughing uncontrollably to myself while listening to you. Keep up the great work. Roll on the season. Can't wait to see Prez pick off Handsome Jimmy a couple times and ram it down his neck after, or a pick six will do. I also think a lot of people are snoozing on us this year. To me, we are looking like we're in great shape, and I have a feeling a few players are going to break out this year and add to it. Signing off with
Catfish,
the 49ers,
Catfish,
the Rams, go Hawks. Thanks from Will from Cork, Ireland."
Oh, Will. Yeah, Catfish, all of them all. And go Hawks, buddy. I do think people are sleeping on us, man. Like, I listen to a lot of the pundits make their picks for week one, right? You know how many times I heard, "Oh, Seahawks, Atlanta, man. I don't know. Tough game to pick. I mean, Atlanta's a talented squad, And like, I just, it, oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Pete Prisco had a hard time with that. In fact, he actually picked the Falcons because he was down on the Seahawks defense. And he said two good quarterbacks going against each other in this game.
Whiff. Yeah, I heard Bill Simmons struggle with this. His cousin Sal struggled with this. Chris Sims struggled with this. Florio struggled with this. Like, come on, guys. Like, this wasn't hard to see coming. I told you.
Yeah, I don't
think... When you play an anonymous franchise week one, you're bound to win.
Bound to win.
Yeah.
So lastly, big thanks to our executive producers, Dustin Mock, Brian Shaw. If you want to get in the flock, go to getintheflock.com, get in at 12 and above. And on the next show, we'll be recognizing our members who come in at 12 monthly. So get in on that. Also, we have a giveaway up at tinypiecesofseahawksstuff.com. Just type Go Hawks in the comments. And we're giving a little Russell Wilson, Tyler Lockett, and Amara Darbo jersey on the... and that tiny piece of Seahawks stuff card.
Yeah. Russell Wilson, Tyler Lockett. No,
what was that last one? Tyler Lockett.
Kind of like, God, what is the name of that movie? It was the really spoofy, campy one. Evil Dead. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where he's got to like repeat the things out of the book.
Plateau Verata.
Darbo. You little flockers really came through this week. I'd like to think that it was the podcast, but I think it was Russell Carrington Wilson that inspired you all. So maybe I am a big fan of this, throw the ball all the time thing.
I'm into it. If it results in wins every single week, I don't care how we get there.
No, and cash money, you bet. I'm in.
What do you say we get on to some do better and better at life?
Yeah, man. I like it. I like it because I'm running out of gas. I'm not going to lie. It's been a long week of travel. So that actually brings me to my do better. And it's not going to be long at all. My do better this week is for the states of Kansas and Nebraska. You're both too damn big and there's nothing to see.
Yeah.
Be smaller. Be less of you. I just don't need that much of Kansas and Nebraska going by my window. For the last 20 hours, like, I've had enough. I don't like you.
Do they at least give you, like, a 75-mile-an-hour speed limit just so you can blow on through?
It depends on the road. If you're on the interstate, yes. But if you get on a side highway, everything is 60-freaking-5 when it's flat as
catfish!
A pancake and straight as a
catfish-freaking
arrow. Kansas and Nebraska, do better. Have something to look at.
Got to respect South Dakota. At least they give you a straight road and a high. I think they may even go up to 85 in South Dakota.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, because of sense. Yeah. I don't get it. I don't get it here.
My do better this week is for Pro Football Focus, Adam.
Mm.
They came out with their own power rankings, or they call them power ratings, because they're not rating, they're not actually ranking anything. It's all numbers going into this.
Sure.
And yeah. I have to question their numbers that they have plugged into this, though, because we watched the San Francisco Arizona game. San Francisco is in their top four after their week one loss to the Arizona Cardinals. KC, Baltimore, okay, 1 and 2. Yeah, that's just about everybody has that. They have New Orleans at number 3. Makes sense. And then, really, the rest of this, there's only one team who lost in the top 12, and it's the number 4 team, San Francisco 49ers. I don't know how it happened. I have my questions because New England's at number 5, and they beat the Miami Dolphins in week 1, and they get a top 5 ranking. The biggest problem I have, though, what are the 49ers doing here? They lost. Do better.
Yeah. Clearly they don't rate. Oh, I don't know. Say like what quarterback you have.
The funny thing is that they put the quarterback on this list for each team. So they clearly rate the quarterback
aware
that you
of
do.
The Jimmy Garoppolo thing.
Yes.
They know he's there.
They know he's there, and they have a spread points above replacement number that goes next to the quarterback's name. Jimmy Garoppolo rates out as high as Ryan Tannehill, which if you watch both those quarterbacks play, you know that Tannehill's the better quarterback. That number doesn't make sense to me. Yeah. He's better.
I'm not sure.
Mahomes is number one in terms of the quarterback SPAR rating. Mm. He has a 9.5 SPAR. Russell Wilson has an 8.5 SPAR. He's number two.
Okay.
I'm trying to give you a sense here because Jimmy Garoppolo's 3.5. And then another guy who's in the top, the other lowest guy in the top 12 is Josh Allen at 1.5.
Wow. Yeah.
I don't know how Jared Goff gets a 5.5.
They don't know how that list even works themselves, I don't think.
The thing that got me was seeing, because I wanted to look at the NFC West teams. You got San Francisco number 4, Seattle number 7, the Rams at number 12, and then Arizona's 18.
Hmm.
I don't know how that works.
Well, maybe it'll even out and be more reflective of how teams really are by the end of the year. Maybe it takes the year's previous record into account.
PFF ELO ratings are PFF's NFL power rankings based on weekly player grades in each facet of play. These power rankings are adjusted based on coach, quarterback, and the market each season. The market.
Yeah. So the way that works is how good your coach is, how good your quarterback is, and what your profit and loss sheet looks like.
Uh-huh.
And how well you invest. Are you are the 49ers diversified?
They might be.
Yeah. They might have some in bonds. They might have some stuff in some hedge funds, probably a couple retirement accounts, an IRA Roth.
Blue jeans.
I mean, they're just, they, you know, if there's one thing I know about people from San Francisco, they know all about wealth management.
That's what has them in the top five.
Yeah.
On to Better at Life.
My Better at Life this week, Brandon, it's for all you little Let Russ cookers. Every one of you, you won this week. You got what you wanted. It happened. Lots of points. Easy peasy win. You know, you guys can do a victory lap. You're all better at life than Skip Bayless.
My better at life than Skip Bayless this week is everybody not named Skip Bayless. And it made me so proud.
The whole planet.
Everybody.
The whole planet.
Everybody.
Wow.
Yeah. It made me so happy this past week when Skip Bayless maybe had the worst take ever in his history on sports television, going after Dak Prescott, saying, did you see this take that?
No.
Dak came out and talked about how he dealt with depression in a really significant way this offseason after the passing of someone who was really close to him. It was his older brother, who was just 31 years old. And, you know, he talked about how that had a huge impact on him, how he didn't even feel like working out. And, you know, he got into a really depressed state. And Skip's take was that he didn't want his starting quarterback talking in this way because he thought it showed weakness. That somehow being depressed is
a human?
Yeah. Yeah, that he was showing weakness because it bothered him so much that he wouldn't work out and that sort of thing. As if depression were the same thing as being bummed out or like a little sad. Like that's how Skip was essentially equating Dax dealing with depression following the death of his brother in the offseason. And so it made me really happy when everybody just came after Skip Bayless. And his take on television. Now, the weird thing was, is that he prefaced it with, I know you guys are going to crush me for this, but here's my take anyway, essentially. That's essentially what he said. So he knew going into what he was about to say, he knew it was just a take just devoid of human emotion. And he did it anyway. And that's what makes Skip Bayless a piece of garbage. Everybody not named Skip Bayless better at life than Skip Bayless.
That's just deplorable. Like, well, and the thing is like, I know I've said things on the show that I usually figure aren't going to be like a popular thing. Right.
Yeah, right.
Like most people aren't going to agree, but it's not about something like that.
Like a person's mental health following a death in the family.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's you're usually bummed something because you like, think that that's going to show a perceived weakness to the team and that his teammates aren't going to respect him now because he got depressed.
Right.
Wow.
After his older brother died.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think most of his teammates are, you know, going to be there for him, you know, because they're actual humans with a soul.
But, you know, there weren't a lot of people agreeing with Skip on that particular take. And that's what made me happy.
No. You know, there's only one other person I can think about that doesn't have a soul right now. You and Clinton discussed him a little bit on Three and Three Out.
Ito Smith. He got it forcefully taken from his body multiple times by members of the Seahawks secondary and linebackers.
Right. So what do you think Ito does now that he doesn't have a soul? Like, since, like, he got Mortal Kombat-ed.
He may end up being... He might end up being the Scorpion of the NFL this year, and that could be dangerous.
Yeah, which, by the way, was my favorite Mortal Kombat character to be.
Because he had the spear.
Yeah! Get over here!
And with that,
there's only one thing left to say.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks.